Great trial lawyers are made, not born. Welcome to Verdict Academy, preserving trial wisdom for trial lawyers. Join host Kevin Morrison, trial attorney in San Francisco, as he recreates those invaluable hallway conversations that remote work has made rare. Candid insights and hard-won lessons from America's most accomplished trial lawyers. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome to another episode of Verdict Academy, where we bring you the best trial lawyers in the country to share their top three trial tips. I'm Kevin Morrison in San Francisco, and this episode's guest is Rainey McGinn, a partner in McGinn, Montoya, Love, Curry & Severs in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I know we overuse the word honored, but I am truly honored to have Randy, who, if there was a Mount Rushmore for trial lawyers, she'd be on it. Randy started her professional career as a journalist, where she learned the art of storytelling. She then went to law school and discovered that she was meant to be a trial lawyer, which she describes as storytelling on steroids. Randy's been helping her clients for over 40 years and has tried over 130 civil and criminal cases to verdict. Her exceptional trial results are numerous. Here are just two. In southern New Mexico, she convinced a jury to award $67 million against Biotronic for implanting medical devices in patients who didn't need them. In 2019, she secured a $42 million verdict against a semi-trailer manufacturer for the family of a 16-year-old boy who was killed in an underride accident. Randy is a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, where she served as its first woman president, as well as the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, the New Mexico Trial Lawyers Association, where she served as its president, and the American Board of Criminal Lawyers, among many other organizations. She's a teacher and she's an author, and she wrote Changing Laws, Saving Lives, How to Take on Corporate Giants and Win, which is published by Trial Guides. Rainey McGinn, welcome to Verdict Academy.
Thanks for having me, Kevin. It's an honor to be here, too.
I'm delighted to have you. Yeah, the format of the show is three trial tips you are going to be sharing. Before I get into those, I'm curious, you've been doing this over 40 years. You are pinnacle of our profession, and you're a woman. I'm guessing in the 1980s, that was even rarer than it is today. How did you get the cojones?
I'd like to say the ovaries, Kevin. I'd like to say the ovaries, that I have the ovaries to do this.
Fair.
When I started, there were really no women trial lawyers. There just weren't any. There were about a dozen of us. In my law school class, it was half women. And there were about a dozen of us that were going to all be trial lawyers. And over time, I ended up being the only one left being a trial lawyer. And part of that I attribute to, at the time that I came up, women weren't allowed to play sports. And the only place women were allowed to compete was in the classroom, where if you worked hard enough, you got an A. And so the other 11 women who were sort of with me and all wanted to be trial lawyers didn't have the experience of learning how to lose. And if you didn't get an A, it was your own fault. And almost every one of them quit after they lost a case because they internalized it so much and hadn't learned how to lose. And fortunately, I ended up playing tennis on the boys' tennis team because they didn't have a girls' tennis team, thanks to Nancy Lopez, who was from New Mexico, the golfer from New Mexico, who filed a lawsuit to allow girls to play in high school and won that lawsuit a year before I started playing tennis on the boys' team. So I learned how to lose, and it didn't bother me as much as the other women that were coming up. And I was sorry to see them go. And now it's terrific, because women are in sports and women know how to lose, and they're turning out to be some of the best trial lawyers out there.
For sure. You've got different skill sets that are, I think, more conducive to connecting with people, more empathetic as a rule. I hate to stereotype. I've seen it before, and I'm sure you absolutely have that in spades. You're a storyteller. Obviously, you're drawn to telling stories since you're interested in journalism and then law school, like my introduction discussed. Is that when you learn that you're going to be a courtroom lawyer, like a trial ad class in law school, Randy?
That's exactly it, Kevin. I went actually for the most morally bankrupt of reasons, which was a newspaper reporter, and I was sending in spec articles to magazines and getting immediately rejected. And I said to my uncle, they're not even reading my stuff. He said, well, if you had an advanced degree, they'd read your stuff. And so I looked at med school, no, too much blood. Said, oh, well, law school, that sounds easy. I'll get a law degree. People will read my stuff. And then by accident, got there and found out it was where I was meant to be. That really, you got to be everything. Not only do you get to write the story, but you get to star in it and direct it. And like I said, you do it really well. A kind of verbal alchemy happens where you turn somebody's story into justice, right? So it was the best of all possible worlds.
Yeah, it's a special thing, a special gift you have. I'm so glad you use it for your clients. Let's talk about those three tips. Tip number one, be your genuine self. Randy, can you tell our audience about that?
Yeah, Kevin, after I came up with that as a tip, I thought, oh, that sounds so like touchy-feely. Really what you want to do is not be the lawyer in the courtroom. You want to be the human in the courtroom. Because people, when you do a survey and say, what do you think of lawyers? What do you think? They say liar, cheat, ambulance chaser, whole list of pejorative words. And interestingly, when you ask them, what would you like lawyers to be? The answer almost universally is, I'd like lawyers to be a teacher. And if they add an adjective, they say, I'd like lawyers to be a caring teacher. And part of the problem is they don't really teach you to do that in law school. They teach you to be aggressive and do all this stuff. That's, by the way, how I started, too. It was not my genuine self when I first got out. They put this lawyer into your head about the lawyer you're supposed to be. And when I first started, there were no women lawyers, so I dressed like all the guys. I had a black suit and a navy blue suit, right? And I even wore those stupid little women ties that they used to have, because I wanted to look like the guys. And then I put my head in this very severe bun like this, because I wanted to look like a guy. But finally, about 3 years in, I saw myself on TV in a case I was trying as a prosecutor. I said, oh my God, I look like my grandfather, for God's sake. And started trying to find a way to be myself in the courtroom. And that has had wonderful results. I don't wear suits when I'm doing jury work. I wear what is my natural style, but turns out to be sort of this teacher thing that I found out years later, which is dresses and like a sweater. All the teachers we had in elementary school, that's the kind of stuff they wore. And women have a tremendous advantage because we get to wear a lot more different kinds of things than the guys do. The guys kind of have to wear a suit in court, right? And you don't have to do that. And so the poor jury comes in and they've seen this stuff on TV, but they don't know what they're doing. And they're so scared and they're looking around for somebody to explain what's going to happen to them. And they gravitate towards the person who looks like them or looks like a teacher or looks like someone they can talk to, not the person in a three-piece suit using all these big fancy words and highfalutin terms. That has been tremendous over the course of my career. I mean, I've had wonderful reactions from jurors. At one point when I was a young lawyer and in your first couple trials, either side objects and objects and objects to throw you off. About half a day in, finally, one of the jurors stands up with this guy objecting to throw me off and says, now you just leave her alone. I had an older woman who probably didn't have the chance to be a lawyer during her day when I was doing closing argument and getting close to the rail, just lean out of the jury box and sort of pat me on the arm, you know, and you think, great, at least I've got one. I've got one. And then one jury in federal court went out and bought me a gift in the middle of trial. Thank God they did not give it to me during trial, Kevin, because I think you'd probably have to report that, wouldn't you? They waited and they gave it to me after trial. So that kind of openness, I think, is important and helping, having it not be about you, but be about the jury and helping them figure out what they need to do. I will say it's particularly hard for young people because you don't know what kind of lawyer you're going to be in the courtroom yet. You don't really know who you are. And so it's okay to try on different things that you see other people do. And then see if it works for you or not. But if it doesn't work for you, everybody can't be Jerry Spence, right? And so if you try some tactic and it doesn't feel right to you, reject that and look for the way that you can communicate with the jury.
Yeah, resonates with me. I know. I mean, I'm totally comfortable with my skin now. And it's been a game when you get older, right? You just frankly stop caring what other people think about you and you're more comfortable and you know who you are. But not in the first couple of trials. I'm scared to death. I don't know what to do. How do you do this? So when did you get comfortable after a certain number of trials? And how would you suggest our younger lawyers, 10, how do they do it?
10 trials.
Okay.
10 trials. I think it takes 10 trials. And sadly, for young lawyers, there aren't that many trials anymore, particularly in the civil arena. So if you really want to become a good trial lawyer, okay, you have to go be a criminal defense lawyer or a prosecutor, because that's where you get a bunch of trials. That's right, Kevin. The first 10 trials, you're just saying, oh my gosh, what happens next? Is this the time when the directed verdict happens? Oh, am I supposed to be ready for directed verdict? And you hear them say something and you say, I know that's an objection, but I can't think of an objection. What's the objection? The good news is, as you do the 10 trials, you'd figure out when you got home, oh, I know what the objection is now. And what happens as you do 10 trials, it gets closer and closer and closer to the courtroom. Now you remember it when you get back to the office. Now you remember it when you get to the parking lot. And finally, after about the 10th trial, you show up and you have the objection in the moment of the trial. And so I think it takes about 10, just so that you know what the rules are and what's going to happen next.
Yeah, definitely. Obviously, you got to know the rules. Also, you know, again, being comfortable in your own skin and remembering it's not about you, it's about the jury. You start to think it's about you. That's never a good place to be. And you lose your nerves and you become much more comfortable. In my opinion, that's how I did. This is about delivering information to the jury.
And the other thing that helps, although it's so painful at the time, is you have to screw up really big. I mean, we're all worried. We're all A-type personalities, and we're worried about screwing up. The only way you get over that is you screw up really horribly, and you go home, and you put the covers over your head. The next day, the sun comes up, and you wake up, and you realize, well, I made a complete fool of myself in court yesterday. But hey, I've lived to do another case, right? Or to come back again and do better today. And so having the worst happen, finally get over the fear of how bad can it be. They're going to haul you off to the gulag when you screw up in court. There, you get another chance to come back and do it better next time.
Yeah, nobody died. Life goes on.
That's it.
All right, point two, trial tip two, the best story wins an opening.
Oh, yeah. People think if I only have the right evidence or the right facts, it is all about story. And when you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, it's the only way you break through to a jury who, from the time they were little kids, had been bombarded with people trying to sell them things. Advertising coming at them from all directions, television and radio, and now on their phones and on their computers. And so the only way to survive in our society is to put up all these barricades to people trying to sell you things. And now you're going to stand up and try to sell them your case. And remember, they're distrustful of lawyers to begin with. And so you have to do what advertisers do. The very most effective ads are those that tell a story. One of my favorite examples of that is the little kid in the Darth Vader outfit, who's going around the house and trying to use his powers on the cat and the dog, and nothing's happening. And he finally walks out to his dad's car and puts his hand up, and the car starts because his dad's inside and pushes the button. And he thinks he has that. Just sucks you right in because you're interested in the story and this little kid is so cute and all that kind of stuff. And that's how Volkswagen gets to your heart, right? The same thing happens in trial. If you tell the best story, you win the case. And research studies show that people decide the case 75% of the time the same way they would decide it after opening statement. I mean, 75% of the time. So you can win it at opening statement, or you still have a chance to screw it up and lose it. That's how I think of it. And so you have to be a student of storytelling if you're going to be a great trial lawyer. And that means when you see a movie that affects you in a powerful way, you have to break down what was it about that, or a book that you read, how was it that they captured me in such a powerful way? And there's all different kinds of ways to tell a story, right? You have to figure out where you're going to start the story, which always makes a difference. Do you start at the very beginning and do it chronologically? Do you start at the end and go back and then tell them the result? And then here's how that all happened. Do you start in the middle? And then you have to decide whose perspective you tell it from, because that makes a huge difference too. Do you tell it from the perspective of your surviving client? Do you tell it from the perspective of your surviving client's mother, who got the phone call that all of us are terrified of getting, that your kid has been in an accident and we don't know if they're going to make it? That may be even more powerful point of view to tell the story from. Just there's so many different ways. The way I tell my book, Changing Laws, Saving Lives, is from reading a book by Sebastian Younger called The Perfect Storm, where if you've seen the movie, the giant wave and they all die. That's the story. The way he tells the book is in a way that is important for trial lawyers, because we have in cases, particularly med mal cases or other cases with complicated mechanics, our tendency is to try to explain all the boring stuff altogether, right? And you lose the jury while you're explaining how the thing works or the devices work or that kind of thing. And what Sebastian Younger does is he starts this story of, a bunch of fishermen who are getting ready to go out sword fishing, what happens, and then they end up on that giant wave and all die. But in between the chronological story, he drops the technical information that you want to use, and he doesn't give it to you all at once. So he starts the chronological story, and then when you need to know how sword fishing works, he drops in some technical information about sword fishing, and now he goes to the chronological story, and you're meeting the guy's girlfriends, and they're saying goodbye as they get on the boat, and now you need something else about how boats roll over in the storms and what kind of buoyancy they have. And he gives you that technical piece. Then he goes back to the chronological story. It's how I wrote my book, to start a chronological story and drop in how lawyers investigate, how lawyers do this, but continues the chronological story so it keeps your interest. And that's a great technique for trial lawyers, to tell the story and then just give the technical, a little piece of technical information at a time, go back to the chronological story and give another technical piece of information, so that you don't lose the jury. That's the kind of stuff that I do. When I see something that really resonates with me, I try to figure out how they made it such a powerful story. I'm not drinking whiskey for your viewers. I'm drinking tea. Okay, just so you know.
No judgment here, Andy. No judgment. You're obviously an elite level storyteller. How do you decide where to start the story? Or is it just gut? Is it thinking about a lot about it, deep thinking? How do you make that decision?
A lot of deep thinking. But in the beginning, we would actually put together stories with different starts or different points of view, and then focus group them and see which one was the most powerful and which one resonated with the jury the most. I mean, I think now after all this time, I have a feel for how the story should go. But at the beginning, you don't know. And so you want to focus group test it and see which one works best.
Do you subscribe to the notion that as a plaintiff, you should make sure the defendant starts to see the errors of the corporate defendant first before they're going on damages? Or are you willing to start a case, the story of the case, you know, how the family survived the death of their child or something like that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
As a general rule, I put their conduct before damages. But there are cases in the right case where they already know that my client's in a wheelchair because they saw them at Invor Dyer, for example. And I may, in the appropriate case, just drop that fact out and then go right back to how this happened. How did this person who was vibrant and alive and all this stuff end up a quadriplegic? Let's talk about how that happened and then go right back into the defense conduct, because that's the most important. One of the greatest ways to do that, of course, is through two-track storytelling, where you start off, the happy family is getting ready to go on vacation, and now you go to, this guy is drinking in a bar. He's had two martinis, and he gets up and goes to the bathroom, and he staggers on the way to the bathroom, and then comes back to the bar and has another two martinis. And now we go back to the family who is setting off on the road, and they're going to Disneyland. It's the first time they're going to go. And then we go back to the guy who's drinking, and he gets up and says, oh, I'm going to go, and he's slurring his words. And he grabs his keys and nobody tries to stop him. And then you go back to the family driving down the road. It's the Jaws technique, right? Dun, 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 dun. That's exactly right. And so the jury is feeling that drama and wanting to stop bartender, stop him and take his keys away before he gets out, or call the cops or do something before they kill this family. They know what's coming because they've seen Jaws, right? That's a wonderful way to tell a story too, and to build up the case and the jury understanding, where you're sort of getting both in at the same time, Kevin. You're talking some about the people who got hurt, and you're talking about the persons with who had did the misconduct too.
And then third, go to your client's home. Talk to us about that, Randy.
Well, at the beginning, right? Because you're a lawyer. When somebody's hurt, you make them come to your office, right? You sit in your office, and somebody told me you need a really big desk, so that makes it sound like you deserve your fee, you know? And that was terrible advice. I mean, the truth is, you cannot convey your client's pain without going to their house, seeing what their life is like since the collision or whatever it is has happened, or malpractice has happened. I was at a client's house last, about 10 days ago, person who suffered malpractice, made it so he couldn't walk anymore because they had to, sort of a malpractice and a product defect case where he had a hip that had metallosis that infected his hip, and they had to take his whole hip out, and he had to sit without a hip for a year while the infection went away. I went to his house that he and his wife had bought, their dream house in retirement, which is down in a mountainous community down south in New Mexico. It's a four-story house. Their bedroom is on the top floor. He can't get up there and hasn't been able to do that for a year. And so every night he has a lazy boy chair on this one level that he can navigate around, where he puts his lazy boy chair down and sleeps right there in the lazy boy chair. And his little dog has a bed right next to him, and the dog stays down there with him. I would not have realized that if I hadn't gone to his house. and seen, you know, this wonderful patio they built out back with a grill and all. He can't get out there because it's got steps down to that. He can't, for the last year, has not been able to access any of this house that they built to retire in. And you don't know that if you don't go. Even if somebody has died, that's even more profound because you see in the house all of the things people have about them, awards they've won or pictures of them. And the worst, of course, is when somebody's child dies, because you go to their house months after the child has died. In one case where this little girl was killed at the hospital, 4 years old, her parents didn't touch anything in her room. So there was the easel where she'd been scribbling, and the scribbles are still on the easel, and the little paper she crumpled up and threw on the ground still there 6 months after she's dead. Nothing touched. All of her toys, this sort of shrine to their four-year-old daughter. Even after we got the case resolved, I think they never moved out of that house because they'd have to shut down the room where their daughter last lived, you know? And so that tells you something about the profoundness of people's grief that you don't get sitting in your office taking notes. Even if you ask them, tell me, how's this affected you? They probably wouldn't even tell you that they haven't changed the room. And you wouldn't know that unless you went there.
We're all so busy, right? It's a lot of emails and phone calls, and you're busy. And it's like, oh gosh, I got to leave the office today and go to my client's home. And that could be a half day or day out of the office, God forbid. And so there's some initial resistance sometimes to taking that kind of time. Every single time I do it, I've driven back to the office a way better advocate, a way better person than the guy who drove to the client's home. 100% true. Yes.
And this one, to go down there, took me, you know, 3 hours down, 3 hours back, right? Could have sent somebody down with a video camera. I could have sent somebody else to scout it out for me. But standing there in the room, you feel their suffering in a way that you don't understand if you don't go there. And the same is true of not just going to your client's house, but you also need to go to the scene of wherever this happened, which is so many people say to me, I just had my expert go out, take a bunch of pictures of the scene of the crash. No. You see things there that you would not see if you didn't go out. You got to go to the scene of where all this happened to.
Always, because then when you're arguing the case or talking about the case of primogeniture, you can actually imagine yourself there and you can paint a much better picture than what's available even off Google Earth or whatever. Yes.
Google Earth is not the same. You got to go there.
Not the same. You got to go there.
Yeah.
Wow.
And let me tell you the example that we had a kid killed. They built our jail way outside of town. And the police were really upset when they built the jail way out of town because they had to drive 17 miles away from town to put somebody in jail, right? So they had to leave. They'd be gone off the beat for 2 hours, off their shift for 2 hours. And so as their own silent protest, they just, when they got off on this two-lane frontage road to go to the jail, they just sped and ran all the stop signs. There were stop signs in two different places. They just ran them because they were ticked off that they had to leave the beat. And they did that for a couple years, and people complained about it, and still nothing got done because the jail was open 24/7, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. At nighttime, when they were speeding, when they came to a stop sign, the way they'd tell if a car was coming is they'd turn their headlights off to see if there were any headlights coming across the road. So my kid, 22, comes out of the racetrack, which is out there, all these things that nobody wants, out the noisy racetrack, is coming out at night and goes to the stop sign and looks to the left and doesn't see anything because, of course, their headlights are off, and pulls out from his stop sign, and this guy hits him at like 75, 80 miles an hour and knocks him sideways up the road and kills him. And we went out to that scene, and as we're standing there at this stop sign, we're watching cop cars just run the stop sign, run the stop sign, run the stop sign. And so we put a video camera on the track premises to record 91 days of police cars running the stop sign. Even after the kid was killed, they kept doing it. I mean, that was powerful evidence of trial. So we wouldn't have known it had we not gone out there.
Well, as expected, the half an hour flew by. I do want to give you one last chance to any parting words to, you know, younger lawyers or folks who want to be trial attorneys, is from Randy McGinn, is what they should do. Or
I just think it's the greatest job in the world. I mean, I love being a trial lawyer. The thing that we love the best is that in our cases, we don't just ask people for money. We find that particularly when our client's loved one has died, it's never just about the money, that they want some change so that somebody else isn't killed and has to suffer the way they do. And so what we do in our cases is make an offer that goes something like this, that we will settle for $5 million if you made no changes, and we will settle for $2.5 million if you make the following 5 or 10 changes in your behavior. And interestingly, we've had about 40% of the companies or governments take us up on the changes. And 60% of them say, well, if we make all those changes, if we have to train people more, if we have to do all this stuff, that's going to come out of our pockets. And if you hit us for a big verdict, the insurance company is going to have to pay. So about 60% of them say, we'll start at the higher number because we're not going to make any changes. And when that happens, now you don't have any qualms about taking it to them at trial and hitting them for as much money as you possibly can. They deserve it because if they were a good company, they would have fixed it already. But the other 40%, we've done wonderful things. We've gotten retraining in hospital situations where they made a medical error to retrain people so they won't miss it again. We've had monuments to kids, tributes to people who died. We've had warning labels put on bad products. I mean, all kinds of things that hopefully someday will put us all out of business and make the community safer. That's the best thing of all.
That's our goal, isn't it? Randy McGinn, thank you for being a guest on Verdict Academy. And more importantly, thank you for all the work you've done for our society, for our community, and for your clients.
You're welcome, Kevin.
Thank you for listening to Verdict Academy. If today's insights resonated with you, please subscribe and share with colleagues. In a world where we see each other less, learning from experienced trial lawyers matters now more than ever. Join us next time. Produced and powered by Law Pods.